You do it. You clap.
3, 2, 1, boom. Yes. Welcome back. And this is episode 3 of Still We Persist. My name is Sienna Kasky. I use she and her pronouns, and I am the AYA Women of Color Initiative Leadership Liaison. Megan is a new co-host we have.
Hi, I'm Megan. I use she, her, herbs pronouns, and I'm the AYA Peer Facilitator at the Hattie Redmond Women and Gender Center. I got into activism through ASOSU initially. I started working within the Oregon Students Association as well, and I did a lot of work there. And now I'm at the AYA Peer Facilitator position, and it's really exciting, and I'm excited to be here today.
Yay! Thanks for joining us. So before we start, like every episode, we're going to begin with our land acknowledgement. Every community owes its existence and vitality to generations from around the world who contributed their hopes, dreams, and energy to making the history that led to this moment. Some were brought here against their will, some were drawn to leave their distant homes in hope of a better life, and some have lived on this land for more generations than can be counted. Truth and acknowledgement are critical to building mutual respect and connection across all barriers of heritage and difference. We begin this effort to acknowledge what has been buried by honoring the truth. What we now call Corvallis, Oregon, it is located within the traditional homelands of the Marys River or Ompanefu Band of the Kalapuyat people. Today, living descendants of these people are a part of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Community of Oregon and the Confederated Tribes of the Siletz Indians. We pay respects to their elders, past and present. Please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us together here today. This statement cannot be an empty recognition of Indigenous peoples, and it must be coupled with true solidarity and allyship and efforts to materially decolonize. Whew. I really like that. And so today, we have an amazing person with us today, and I'm so happy that she's with us. We have Luhui Whitebear, who is an enrolled member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation. Luhui is the Assistant Director of the OSU Native American Longhouse Ina House, as well as PhD candidate in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality program at OSU. She's received her BS in Ethnic Studies, BS in Anthropology, and MA in Interdisciplinary Studies, which focuses on WGSS, Ethnic Studies, and Queer Studies. Lou is a mother, poet, and Indigenous activist. Her research focuses on Indigenous rhetorics, indigeneity, and reclaiming Indigenous identity and gender roles, missing and murdered Indigenous women, Indigenous resistance movements, and national laws and policies that impact Indigenous people. Lou is passionate about disrupting systems of oppression and creating positive change in society. So thank you so much for being on the show. I don't know if you have anything else that you want to add.
Yeah, I'm just really happy to be here and excited to have a conversation with you all. And also, I use she, her pronouns.
Yeah. Thank you. So we're going to go right into it. And based off of like their bio, we want to know, like, how are you currently disrupting systems of oppression? Mm-hmm. And are there any tips that you have that you want to share as an Indigenous organizer or things that you've learned?
Yeah, so I think it depends on which part of systems of oppression we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about on campus? Are we talking about in the community? Are we talking about nationally? So there's
different
ways. Let's
start with campus.
Okay. Yeah, so on campus, there's a lot of work that I've been trying to engage with, and part of it that I am really excited to work on is that has to do with institutional data and the way that OSU reports data out kind of erases students' identities in a way. So I don't know if you all are aware, but like and when you fill out the admissions form, you can check more than one race, of course, because people have multiple identities, which is super valid and important to have that option. But once the data gets here, when it gets reported out, people, whether or not they know, are lumped into a multiracial. And so that changes graduation rates and retention rates for a lot of communities. And so I started looking at that a little bit ago and have been working with other folk on campus about how we can possibly report it out differently, where it honors people's multiple identities, but more accurately reflects who's here, because the story that's told is always one that's of a deficit. So like, for example, the Indigenous students on campus that I primarily work with are always said like they have the lowest retention rates, the lowest graduation rates, especially Indigenous men. But when we change the data to include people from multiracial and also the if you check Hispanic in another race, you go to Hispanic, mm-hmm. and it's not counted anywhere else. It doesn't go to multiracial too. And so when we got all the data deaggregated, it significantly changed the graduation rate.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so I think like that's one way of like, it's not like a huge, I think it's a huge thing because how we talk about students, also like how students see themselves as being capable of success and graduation and that sort of, and that form of success, because I think success is also defined differently depending on the community and the individual person as well. So that's one example, I guess.
Is
I
that
could get
part of your research that you're doing?
No.
With your PhD? Just your side,
It's just something I'm involved with. Just,
nice.
And part of that work is from also working with Jesse Nelson and also on the President and Provost, President and Provost Leadership Council for Equity and Inclusion.
Wow.
So that's the formal committee that I'm on that has been doing a little bit of work on that.
Awesome.
And so, yeah. And then other ways too that I think of is just continuing to advocate for students. Like I work with students every day, of course, in the NAL, and hear what needs are and advocating for those needs, and whether they be in larger university meetings or in smaller meetings, and trying to create change where they feel more supported. And so sometimes that leads to big changes, like developing the Learning Living Community that's starting next fall.
Yeah.
And so that's exciting, the Mookskookum one. And like working with other campus partners too, like behind the scenes to help get that started and make sure it's gonna be something that can continue forward. Because one of the things I really do not like doing is when I'm presented with an opportunity to help work on something is like, well, is it gonna keep continuing on? And I think that's also a way of disrupting systems of oppression, because I think sometimes things are like patchworked and then, but there's not a lasting like change in that regard, because then funding was only for 1 year or 2 years. So how do we make sure this is something that will continue?
Right.
And so like those are the questions I ask before I get involved with things too, is like, well, what's the long term? Because like, yeah, there's the short term like impact, but there has to be something more, because then people get excited about stuff and get used to things and feel supported, and then it's gone.
Right.
And that's not okay.
No. So what about outside the OSU community? Because like I feel like you are involved with many different communities, but like what's been
So in I would say like in the local Corvallis community, my youngest daughter was bullied really bad her first year in kindergarten last year and had her arm broken by this kid. And so some of that work has been holding the school accountable. And like how I did that was they didn't really do anything at first, and then I withheld her from going to school until they had something in writing, in agreement with me, so that she would feel more safe going to school and a plan, and also like her medical bills would be paid and stuff. Like practical stuff like that. And I think by withholding her from school, it was sending a stronger message than just like emailing back and forth. Because like she doesn't feel safe, and I don't feel like she's safe there. And so what sparked from that was working with other parents from the school, as well as a couple other schools in town, on making some recommendations on changing how the schools are talking about bullying in the curriculum that they're using.
Yeah.
We found out that the teachers weren't involved with the curriculum that the students were receiving, so they didn't know what the students heard. And so asking that the teachers actually be part of that instead of using it for a prep time.
Yeah.
And so that's some of the, like the more local stuff, and also working with some of the local environmental organizations on talking about climate justice and how to really work with indigenous communities on that, instead of it just being like an accessory piece, or or saying, hey, Lou, can you come do the land acknowledgement and that's it, you know what I mean? Like how do we engage this conversation deeper and talk about frontline indigenous communities, because those are the ones who are impacted first. And so that's some of the community work, and also helping bring folk to town with other community organizers that talk about things like white fragility, or like we're showing a film this evening about the Doctrine of Discovery, like people don't know about that kind of stuff. And that was in partnership, that one was with the NAL and a community partnership, but some of the other stuff I do on the side is outside of my scope of work. And then in the larger, broader sense, I do some talks and educational stuff about murdered and missing Indigenous women, and have done some policy advocacy work at the state level for that too. So that's kind of some of the things I've done for that because of being a state employee, I do take personal time off and use my vacation time to go do that kind of stuff, which I don't mind doing at all because it's really important. And if we're not out there advocating for our missing relatives, then who is? And I think that's part of the MMIW movement in general, is that it's Indigenous women who are going out and doing searches. They're the ones who are going out and advocating for policy changes. Mm-hmm. And like with the state of Oregon, that legislation is for cross-jurisdictional cooperation between federal, tribal, and state law enforcement mm-hmm. agencies and local ones to try to get the numbers accurate for the crisis here in Oregon. And so that's one example. And like I already mentioned, I do some stuff around climate justice as well. That's like one of my background passions since I've been a kid, has been like standing up against like corporate extractive companies.
Of course. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. They're not my favorite.
Nope.
I lost my first home to an oil company. And so, and have been like trying to make a stand ever since. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're like, I've been here. This is nothing new, which I really appreciate. And the climate protest that happened on campus earlier mm-hmm. this term, mm-hmm. y'all were like the NAL folks were asked to lead it, correct?
Yeah, we were. And that was the first time that has happened in town, actually. Which says a lot too, because a lot of times like people are like, oh yeah, Native people, and then they forget that we should be involved with things. And and so I thought it was really cool, because at first it was more like, hey Lou, can you come talk at this panel and mm-hmm. then come talk at the rally? And I was like, sure. And then it turned into other community members asking for the NAL specifically to help lead the march. And so I talked to the staff, because I don't ask them to like participate in things I don't want to, because like, it's if they're passionate about something, then I'll support it. And if they want to participate in something like that, and OSU had sent out some stuff, so I felt like it was appropriate and stuff like that. And they all wanted to join in, at least most of them. And we walked down with everybody and led the march and stuff. So that was really cool to have everybody behind them. And I thought it was a really powerful moment for the students that were participating to be part of that.
Awesome.
Yeah, and everybody was all yay when they walked down to the waterfront. It was cool, because we joined up with a bigger group. So
yeah, that's awesome.
That's really cool. It's been like a really fun experience to like get to do that. So another question that we kind of have, I know you kind of brought up sort of your motherhood and your experiences with that, and I think it's really great that you were able to stand up to the school for like what they did. But like, how has motherhood in general impacted your activism?
I think that it's just been part of it, you know what I mean? Because I was kind of born into activism, and so my parents met protesting an LNG pipeline.
That is so cool.
And so it's always been part of my life, even before I was on the earth.
That's awesome.
And I've always brought my kids to stuff and explained to them what we're doing. And I feel like it's part of our responsibility to carry that on, because Indigenous folk have been resisting settler colonialism since contact. And this is just this version of that resistance of like, how do we protect the water and how do we protect the earth and how do we maintain our cultural identities as Indigenous people? And so just even little things like explaining to the school like why my son had long hair and stuff like that when he was younger, and or supporting my kids when they say something in class that speaks truth. And so I get involved with the schools in a lot of different ways, I think, because of being Native and misrepresented in K-12 heavily. And so like when my kids would say something in class, and if there was, if their teacher shut them down, then I would send them an email, or I'd have a conversation with them and be like, hey, you know, this is how it landed, this may not have been your intent. Or even if the curriculum was really messed up, like one year, Oregon's never celebrated Columbus Day, first of all. And so I don't know why it's part of Oregon curriculum. But in he had nothing to do with like actual U.S. history in general, but he just helped start the wave of colonization and all. But as far as like United States history, he didn't really play a role, in, if you think about it. And then, so I'm like, why is it part of your U.S. history curriculum, you know what I mean? And then one year, the teacher had mentioned like how he was a really brave person and stuff like that, and it really landed a certain type of way with my older daughter. And so I emailed the teacher and just let her know, like, you probably had a reason for saying that, but this is how it impacted one of your Indigenous students who grew up understanding what the truth was around Columbus. And her reply back was like, well, I'm part Indigenous too. And it was like very like minimizing when people do that. And it's like, that's not really what I was asking. I wasn't asking if you're Indigenous or not. I was like letting you know how it impacted my kid, whether or not, whatever your identity is. And so that was, so I was all, okay, thanks. Well, you still need to understand that it impacted her negatively. So I think like standing up and helping advocate for my kids is teaching them how to do that for themselves too. And the older that they get, the more they're able to do that. And then they go to a lot of stuff with me too and come listen to me talk in, at rallies, or they'll go on marches with me and stuff like that. And we all went to Standing Rock. It was me and my elder parents and all my kids, all three of them. And so we drove all the way over there, and to do ceremony is what we were going for. And we brought the tribal flag with us for my stepdad's tribe. But so just like having them involved with that, they've never not been involved either. And so, yeah, that's how it's impacted. I think it's just been part of it, and being a mother's great too.
That's so nice to hear.
Yeah,
I love that.
That makes me, I don't know, that makes me feel better.
I know.
Like that there's, I don't know. I think motherhood is really special.
It is.
And to see, like, I feel like you're doing it well.
Thanks.
Yeah, really, I think it's also because I've seen you interact with your kids, and I think that like it's really comforting to see like women of color as mothers and but powerful.
Yeah.
And so I really applaud you for that.
I think one thing too about like how activism with motherhood too is because like being a single mom in itself is its own thing. Like being able to be like, I'm making this choice to like prioritize my kids and also to make sure that they're they have their house and stuff like that. And so I think like there's a lot that goes into single motherhood that doesn't get talked about, and I think like it's its own form. I don't know if I would say it's its own form of activism, but maybe in some ways it is. And being able to still advocate for them and be engaged in the community with them, I think I don't know how much that would have happened if it wasn't how it is with us. So. But you never know.
You never know. Our next question is, what's it like being the NAL assistant director? Native American Longhouse, for those that don't know.
It's fun. There's a, I think it's really great to be in community. I was, I worked at the Longhouse when it was in the Quonset Hut as an undergrad, so I understand how special having a community space like that is and what it means as far as being able to get through some rough experiences on a predominantly white institution. And being able to be part of the NAL in a different way, like a more mentoring way, has been really special to me too. So I feel like my relationship has changed over the years with the NAL, because it was like my source of community, and now it's like more of a mentorship role and helping deal with stuff so students don't have to, like, as far as building maintenance and that kind of things you all don't need to worry about, and reservation requests and stuff, and just helping be like that person when problematic stuff comes in, that they're like, here's my supervisor's card, or can I get your, here's her email. That way it's kind of a buffer. And we do experience a lot of microaggressions at the NAL especially, and a lot of it's rooted in people not understanding what they're asking is inappropriate because they're not exposed to Native people, because, well, we already talked about how K-12 misrepresents Native people, especially as being something of the past and not living in the present. And so I think that carries over to people coming in asking inappropriate things. And so it's a lot of just supporting students, and I really enjoy seeing them develop their leadership and develop their voice. I'm always really proud of them when they are able to like feel confident enough to speak up about something that they don't think is right on campus.
The NAL crew like is so badass. It is unbelievable. Like I think like you leading them is really special too, because y'all are just like a powerhouse of change, I feel. It's true. I mean, if you think
about it,
like last year when all the budget stuff was going on, like it was like me and some other folks working with the NAL folks just trying to organize and get information about student fees, which is so important. And so I think like, are you the first assistant director for the NAL? So how,
wow.
So you went from like being a student there
than to run in the place. Mm-hmm. But that's how.
Well, I mean, there was a gap between.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah.
Tribe,
but yeah. But so how's that been?
It's been good. It was very like my first year. I took a very like observant like how does things operate now on campus? Yeah. What do the students want? And I wanted to make sure they knew I wasn't there to take over. I was there to support them. Mm-hmm. And so just building those relationships with the students was the most important to me my first year, and then just being able to continue to support them. And and like what you said, like with the budget stuff last year, I was really proud of them too. Yeah. I was like, you all can use your voice, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's up to you. Mm-hmm. And they had questions about it, and I'm like, I'm not gonna tell you what you can and can't do as a student to advocate for yourself. And so I think that that's important for all students to know.
Mm-hmm. And so also, like, how do you see like the future for Indigenous scholars too, like on at maybe like broadly nationally, but like at this university?
Mm-hmm. I think it depends on what program we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Like our program in WGSS has a really high number of Indigenous students, which is amazing, in the PhD and master's program.
Wow, that's awesome.
And so like bringing new ideas and developing scholarship for other students to follow down that path too, I think, and continue work that other Indigenous scholars before have started, I think is really cool. I don't know what other programs look like as far as numbers, but I feel like more Indigenous folk are understanding like it's not just about like having the degree, it's about how to apply the knowledge and how to assert our own knowledge systems and our own theories and stuff. And so I think like there's a lot ahead for Indigenous scholars, and especially with developing stuff that people can use, because I don't know if you all have tried to do research papers and on certain topics. And it can be like hard, right? You have to use like dominant framework material, and so the more Indigenous folk that get stuff out there for students to use, so that was one of the things that inspired me to like submit my article I wrote about VAWA for publication, which I did get published, which I was super excited, is like when I was writing my paper for class, it was really hard to find material that's like scholarly material, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, wow. And so I'm excited that people have something they can cite, and and there's more stuff coming out too.
Oh, exciting.
That's super cool.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I think we're at our last question.
Yeah, we are. So the last question we really have for you is, do you have any words of wisdom to share with the Aya community?
I would just say to be true to who you are, and that you all have beautiful spirits and beautiful and have powerful voices inside of you all, and don't be afraid to ever use them, because the systems we live in tell us that basically that we're not valid and that basically that we're nothing. And so don't let that perception direct who you are or what you do. And I think that the more that women of color especially and are able to reclaim our voices and use them in really powerful ways, a lot of change can happen. And these systems are scared of us, so we can shake it up.
Yeah. You hear that, systems?
We don't like you, systems.
We're
don't
coming like for you.
Wow, that was amazing. So thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you.
Do you have anything else that's coming up that you want to share?
Yeah.
Maybe stuff. Sure, yeah. It's Native Heritage Month. Yay!
Woo!
So next week we have an Indigimas, an identity panel, and then we have our Native Beast, and we also have, next week's not Indigimas. Next week is our Indigenous Trans and Two-Spirit Stories of Resilience event that we're doing with the Indigenous Queer and Two-Spirit class. Awesome. So it's a collaboration with them. Yeah. And then we have our Native Feast is our last event. So, and be on the lookout for next term and the following term.
Yeah. Very exciting. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for tuning in. Again, if you have any comments or want us to cover a topic, please add us on Instagram at Aya_OSU. Thank you so much.
Thank you.